Yet the primary points of opposition, the Aryan use of genetic slavery and the joint control of crystal energy management remained unresolved. The rise of militarism. From within the Sons of Belial had risen a hypnotic charismatic leadership who seduced the masses in Atlantis into believing they were the force destined to returning Atlantis to its lost golden age of prominence and abundance. The leaders of this group were the souls now known as Hitler and Himmler, the supremacist Nazis of World War II. Large militaristic legions were formed and gained the edge in covert political persuasion and power. The hybrid mutants were used to terrorize those who opposed them in Aryan and Dog, and on one occasion this was futilely attempted in Poseida. The powerful Aryan contingents were masters of manipulation and media. They presented well-thought-out arguments that masked their true intentions and promised mutual compromise. The propaganda seemed quite feasible on the surface and convinced many, including moderates and some from the law of one, of its hope for harmony. That which was known as the second moon of Atlantis, the crystalline power grids and fire crystals came under federal governmental control, and their usage became altered as the area knowledge of the programming grew. The Atlara were able to direct their usage towards military uses initially, but in time were deterred. The second moon of Atlantis was a massive crystalline satellite, of Acturian construct managed by the Atlara priest-scientists of the Law of One. This crystalline satellite was an enormous unmanned sphere of brilliant engineering, approximately 5 miles in diameter. It had been in use since the Golden Age of Atlantis, and served myriad benevolent purposes. It amplified and controlled the various crystal beams sent from the fire, healing and energy crystals. It was something of a computerized macro chip that refracted, amplified and reflected powerfully refined beams of energy for use in agriculture, weather control, tide control, healing temples, regeneration temples and the enhanced energy systems generated by the crystal power system. It loomed in the skies over Atlantis and appeared as a golden harvest moon, and thus was known as the second moon of Atlantis. A rainbow kaleidoscopic energy band of anti-gravity plasma swirled around the sphere, and often appeared as what you now term the aurora or northern lights. The satellite crystal moon did not orbit the Earth, it moved as programmed, self-directed, constantly shifting locations in order to perform its myriad tasks over Atlantis, Africa and the eastern seaboard of Brazil. The Aryan Belial scientists, with the Council approval, reprogrammed a system bypass and began sending destructive thermal light beams used to initiate volcanic eruptions and massive earthquakes against the colonies and their nations who refused to give in to their demands. These were aimed in the areas of what is now Greece and Turkey, and caused great devastation. Indeed, it gave the zealous Aryans the battle advantage they so fervently desired, and they jubilantly increased its usage, with support of most of the populace. The crystal moon began to overload, weakening the anti-gravity field that kept it afloat. The Atlara scientist priesthood of Poseidon understood the implications of what would soon occur when the programming crashed, but their pleas to the council continued to be ignored. After several months of prolonged war use, the second moon satellite began to swerve and shift erratically, and power blackouts began to occur. Tireless attempts to correct it were unsuccessful. The Atlara were asked to lend support in correcting it, but most refused. Some agreed to try and stabilize it to prevent the impending disaster. All attempts failed. The Aryan-led National Council refused the suggestion to incinerate the satellite, disbelieving that it would crash, and held to minimizing the effects of an impact even if it did. Indeed, after a few months of being utilized for the thermal death ray technology, the Great Crystal Satellite overloaded, its anti-gravity cushion weakened and it crashed with the accelerated velocity of a massive comet in a horrific explosion that devastated most of the island of Og and critically weakened the tectonic stability of the Atlantean plate, vaporizing massive sections of substrata. The Great Crystal Satellite shattered into billions of fragmented crystalline shards, which now fill the deep trenches of the Atlantic. Massive clouds of dust and smoke erupted, hiding the Sunday waves of earthquakes and tsunamis devastated the island and sent great tidal waves over two-thirds of the Isle of Aryan. Within minutes, the remaining power stations exploded with the strength of nuclear bombs. The remains of one such crystal power station explosion can be seen to this day in the area of northeast Brazil called Sertiades. Atlantis, and the eastern coast of Brazil and the western coast of Africa were devastated with subsequent earthquakes. Panic and havoc ensued for 3-4 weeks as the remaining dry areas shook, and landmasses collapsed into the sea, creating enormous tsunamis. The land bridge that connected Posida and Og to the Yucatan remained above water initially and was literally filled with hundreds of thousands of Atlanteans frantically attempting to escape in a horrendous panic-filled exodus. Every type of seagoing vessel was filled with the surviving terrorized refugees. And then in one shattering gasp, the remaining lands of Atlantis collapsed downward into the sea. The displaced seas that became known as the Great Flood sent dozens of enormous tsunamis that spilled over the Americas, Africa and Europe. Only a few mountain tops of Atlantis, the Azores, remained dry. But the survivors were distraught, traumatized across the globe. Very few places were unaffected. A downward spiral in the civilizations of Earth had begun. And so it was after the destruction and sinking of Atlantis that the largely depopulated Earth was left to a long period of the Dark Ages following the Great Flood, which swept the rest of the world with only a relatively small remnant of simple agrarian people left. The world after Atlantis. The concurrent great continental civilizations were largely influenced by certain outside extraterrestrial races, with two contrary motivations: to try and improve the primitive indigenous tribal civilizations of Earth, or in some cases, to try and control them for their own subjective benefit. The other world races whose intentions were positive, to add to the beneficial development of Earth, were the Pleiadians from the nearby Pleiadian star system and also the Sirians from the Sirius star system. Those with negative intent, that of furthering their own subjective control on Earth, consisted of some of the renegade extraterrestrials from the outer regions of the Orion constellation, also from the great galaxy-wide group of racial opponents of the human race, the reptilians who felt they had been given a natural right to take over the whole Milky Way galaxy, pushing aside the human races in the process. There was another positive outside source of beings which came to Earth in order to accelerate the planet's evolution. These were the more highly evolved members of the central universes, the descending beings, who came down here to try to teach and show us a better way through their living example. These highly evolved beings normally entered into the more developed worlds of Earth and have continued to do so right down to the present day, many as members of the explorer race. They have also encouraged their own offspring within the central universes to follow their example by incarnating into the lower physical worlds such as planet Earth, in order themselves to benefit from the powerful learning experience to be gained in such places. About 5,000 years after the fall of Atlantis, there appeared on the scene an important group of extraterrestrial colonizers known as the Anunnaki, the astronauts of the Nibiruan race, residents of their mobile battleship planet Nibiru. Their interest was in Earth's gold mining possibilities, as they badly needed a source of gold to repair their planet's radiation-damaged surrounding atmosphere. This was caused by nuclear radiation which their battle planet had sustained in their participation in the many galactic wars within our galaxy. It was this ET race that was to create the great Sumerian civilization in Mesopotamia. The Nibiruans, who then descended to Earth in their space shuttlecraft, appeared to the relatively few and simple folk left on Earth after the Great Flood cataclysm as truly gods. These gods were soon to use their advanced abilities in genetic engineering to genetically alter them into becoming obedient slave workers, which they called the Lulus. They then used them to mine and exploit Earth's gold mineral resources in the large gold mines they were to establish on the continent of Africa. Their mobile battleship planet Nibiru was originally built in the Pleiades by the Galactic Federation for mainly galactic peacekeeping purposes. The Nibiruans themselves originated in the Pleiades, but were by nature a more aggressive warlike race, having split off from the more benevolently natured Pleiadians. Nibiru was constructed as a hollow sphere 4 times the size of planet Earth. Its 4D inhabitants live totally within the interior of the planet, where they enjoy a fully verdant landscape complete with lakes and rivers similar to those on Earth. However, the mobile planet Nibiru is at present confined to following a permanent long orbit ranging from our solar system to the Sirius system and back as a Galactic Federation punishment for their past interference on Earth. They re-enter our solar system every 3.6 thousand years and then exit to the Sirius star system to then return back again to our solar system in an endless fixed orbit. At the present time, the fourth dimensional Nibiru is once again passing through our solar system, invisibly cloaked from our limited 3D Earth vision. The Nibirurans were at one time in the distant past briefly involved with Earth, long before the formation of Atlantis, but then only returned after the Great Flood during Earth's long Dark Ages in order to mine our supplies of gold mineral resources in Africa. They badly needed this source of gold in order to create a protective radiation shield around Nibiru after it had been exposed to nuclear attacks during its former use as a battle planet in the many galactic wars it had been involved with. They soon found that the relatively simple indigenous Earth survivors left after the Great Flood were very easy material to genetically transform into becoming obedient gold mining slaves to work in their gold mines. These simple-minded Lulus had their 12-strand DNA reduced down to 2 strands, allowing them just enough intelligence to receive work instructions, but with limited mental capabilities to disobey. The 2-strand DNA introduced into them, and which soon spread throughout Earth's interceding humanity, is still a part of our present genetic makeup. This accounts for the fact that most of us at present have the use of only 10-20% of our potential mental capabilities, but which will be fully restored to our former 12-strand DNA when we finally step up to the fourth dimension, vibrational rate, after Earth's ascension. However, the ruling Nibiruan family on Earth, although looked up to at the time by the simple Lulus as gods, were themselves prone to constant bickering and fighting within their upper hierarchy. It was through the infighting in their constant internal power disputes that they eventually devastated a large area of Mesopotamia in 2024 BC with the use of a plutonium bomb, creating a vast barren desert in what was a formerly verdant area. This infighting between their leaders led to their great Sumerian civilization's rapid decline and the departure of Earth's former gods. Nonetheless, since then the Nibiruans, originally named Hibiruan Earth, later to become renamed as the Hebrew, have largely retained a covert control over Earth within various major governments, and particularly within our banking and financial institutions right up to recent times. The seventh bestowal incarnation on planet Earth by Christ Michael of Nibiruan. When a Trinity Creator Son goes out from the Paradise Isle to create and maintain a local universe, he takes an oath to the Eternal Trinity Father not to assume full control of that local universe until he has experienced a final bestowal incarnation. This involves undertaking a series of incarnations on one each of his worlds in a descending order of the 7-dimensional vibrational levels within the local universe to obtain full sovereignty. As the Urantia book describes it, the bestowals are a kind of education in justice and mercy. The sons are not only to be just and merciful by nature, but incarnation as a creature of the realm gives them a unique on-the-ground experience and understanding that they can find in no other way. Thus it was that following on from the fall of Atlantis and the later Nibiruan-led Sumerian civilization, the next major event in Earth's history took place over 2,000 years ago when Christ Michael of Nibiruan finally made his 7th and final bestowal incarnation on one of his youngest and lowest planets, Urantia, Earth, but in this case he made it as a joint incarnation with Jesus Emmanuel, Sananda. This followed his series of 6 previous incarnations on a chosen selection of his over 3,000 planetary worlds in a descending order of dimensional frequency and development. Though the purpose of the bestowal incarnations is to educate the Trinity Creator Son himself, rather than to manage local affairs, this was indeed a very significant event for the somewhat embattled and quarantined planet Earth. Not only was the bestowal incarnation made here in order to bring some spiritual light to a by now very dark world, but it was to allow Michael of Nobaden to finally qualify as a full sovereign of his local universe, following his long probationary period as acting regent of Nobaden on behalf of his Trinity Father. Christ Michael's final bestowal incarnation on Earth was however undertaken through a joint incarnation between Christ Michael of Nobaden and S.U., Jesus Emmanuel. S.U. Emmanuel was the first son of Gabriel, the chief administrative officer of the local universe of Nobaden. Gabriel was himself the very first offspring of the union of Christ Michael and his ruling co-partner, Nobadonia, when they were first jointly setting up the local universe of Nobaden. Jesus Emmanuel, thus in fact a distant grandson, was chosen by Michael of Nobaden to be his actual physical incarnated human being partner on the ground, continually overshadowed by the Creator Son Michael from a higher plane. In this way Christ Michael was personally able to experience fully all of the ups and downs of this most difficult bestowal life on one of his most backward and undeveloped physical planets. Christ Michael thus was personally to experience all the trauma and pain of the final crucifixion on the cross. Michael of Nobaden's final bestowal incarnation made on planet Earth allowed him not only to achieve his final qualifying experience on one of his most difficult, unruly and backward planets, but secondly, to try and instill a new message of adopting a new life's path of unconditional love to the self-serving and warring peoples through his partner, Jesus Emmanuel. This message was initially and still remains one of the fundamental building blocks of what became Christian faith. During the Middle Ages, the faith itself and its message was subverted by the Catholic Church into a means of control, suppression and acquisition of immense wealth. The movement by Martin Luther and others known as Reformist, or Protestant, was basically a reaction against the many injustices of the Church, particularly the sale of the indulgences, or certificates of remission, to wealthy and poor alike, supposedly to spare them from years of hell and purgatory. Coming to the final and terrible event of the crucifixion, Gabriel, as father of Jesus, Emmanuel, was himself there overhead as a horrified witness, watching its unfoldment in mounting fury from his mothership, but not allowed to intercede. He had to quietly endure the dreadful taunting and humiliation given out by the townspeople to his son on the cross. The great darkness that spread over the land was therefore caused by the shadow of his enormous mothership overhead that blotted out the Sunday. Its massive magnetic influence upon the atmosphere also brought on the ensuing dramatic and massive electrical storm, forcing the attending crowds to flee to their homes in panic. The placing of Jesus in the tomb of Joseph of Arimathea, a devout follower of Jesus, came about after Joseph had sought permission from Pilate to place Jesus in his own private tomb set into a stone cliff and which was to have a large circular stone rolled across the entrance. Joseph, after having placed the body there, received a mental message from Gabriel in his mothership overhead that Jesus was in fact only in a comatose state. He therefore quickly returned to the city of Jerusalem and searched out and found some known healing friends of Jesus from India. With special herbs and ointments they returned to the tomb, entering through a secret side entrance and passage, and nursed him for 3 days and nights until he finally recovered and his strength was fully restored. After the body of Jesus was placed in the tomb of Joseph of Arimathea, the overshadowing spirit of Christ Michael ascended separately to the higher spiritual realms to resume rulership of his local universe, now as the full sovereign of Nobaden. However, Jesus did in fact physically survive the experience and was able to live on in India for a further 100 years. S.U., Jesus Emmanuel later reappeared several times in the flesh to the astonishment of his disciples. The final occasion was when they were unsuccessfully fishing in the Sea of Tiberia. He appeared before them and told them to throw the net out to the right side of the boat, and you will catch a great number. This they did and they were amazed to fill the net with a great multitude of fish. After giving them a final lesson on the laws of the formation, a large silver spacecraft descended and took him off to Damascus, Syria. He spent 2 years in Damascus before sending for his faithful brother Thomas, and also his favorite disciple Thomas, as well as his close friend Judas Iscariot, not to be confused with his betrayer, Judas Iscariot, son of the Pharisee Simeon, who had already chronicled much of the life of Jesus, These chronicles were hidden in Joseph of Arimathea's tomb, later to be removed and rehidden, the contents only to be finally revealed in the Christ Michael, Hatton, Phoenix Journal of 6 August 1989. He also brought to Damascus his beloved mother, Mary, and his wife and twin soul, Mary Magdalene. They then all traveled to northern India, now West Pakistan, where he preached and taught the people, using the name Asu. His mother, however, was soon to pass away, and eventually he and his wife and companions finally settled in Srinagar, Kashmir, where he continued to act as a spiritual teacher up to his final passing away at the age of 137 years. After the forthcoming earth changes, Su/Jesus/Sananda will be once again descending to the new 4D earth, the long prophesied second coming, for a period as planetary prince, regent. One of the planetary prince's roles will be to oversee the upholding of Earth's new constitution, which apart from laying down the basic rules, obligations and limitations on Earth's governments, enshrines the basic code of human conduct. Do unto others as you would have them do unto you. The new world constitution will ensure that day-to-day governance by Earth's leaders is conducted with honesty, propriety and in accordance with the newly established constitutional principle of liberty, freedom up to the point where you do not infringe the freedom of another. Chapter 3, Free Will, Karma and Morality. Evolution is a process of learning through choice, and to this end we have all been granted by the cosmic creator source of all formation the gift of free will, free choice. Free will is exercised down at Earth's dense physical level in the most extreme difficult conditions. On higher spiritual planes it is possible to see in a single moment the probable outcomes of various alternative paths, and it is therefore a much simpler matter to make the right choice. But since the Earth plane is clouded by the surrounding veil, it is not possible for us to see clearly the future outcomes of our choices. We on Earth have to go through the more arduous process of physical experience. We have to make blind choices, trying to weigh up all the barely perceivable advantages or disadvantages to self and to others, then experience the full consequences of those choices. Frequently we also experience the painful consequences of those negative or inappropriate actions returning upon us. All this does make us much stronger and more aware beings than if we had only experienced the smoother and easier path enjoyed on higher worlds. Central to the concept of free will is the law of karma, or the law of cause and effect. The law of karma is also known as the great law of balance. In the process of living, evolving, experimenting and learning, our actions affect others either harmfully or beneficially, thus incurring numerous and often complex debts or credits on our own evolutionary balance sheet of progress. The law of karma requires that the effects which our actions have on others and all other life forms must always be finally balanced. When we harm others, we incur a debt to ourselves as well as to them, and likewise when others harm us, they incur a debt to themselves as well as to us. Debts for good or bad, whether through ourselves or caused by someone else, must eventually be balanced by both parties. Similarly, when you harm or injure your own spirit, self through incorrect living and misuse of your own physical body, you create an imbalance as a karmic debt to your soul. That can only be rebalanced through your achieving an awareness of those incorrect actions and avoiding them in the future. Thus all actions which prove to be of a negative nature must be finally balanced out by those of a positive nature to erase the karmic debt. This is something you owe to your soul, self, as well as permitting you to eventually ascend up to higher spiritual levels. The Master Zen Tao: do not see karma only as a plus or minus column in a divine accountant's book in which is recorded what you owe to someone because of the wrong that you have done them. It does not work in that way. It is rather a teaching process in which you learn from what you have done. It is you that has created those ripples on the pond of life, and they will in turn affect you. The purpose of karma is not punishment. It is rather a process of balance and education. On higher spiritual levels there is no judgmental criticism of one person by another. Karma is an objective, automatic, totally dispassionate process, one of rebalancing that which we, or others, have already put out of balance. Only through this great law of balancing, or cause and effect, we can truly learn from and experience the results of our actions on others. From wrong actions taken, wrong effects will flow. We have to then revisit and recreate those sets of circumstances over and over in repeated incarnations until we learn from their ill effects, eventually choosing the right path. To determine whether we have corrected and overcome our karmic debts, tests will be instigated by our higher self and repeated until we ourselves have determined that we have fully balanced them through our own acknowledgement, acceptance and assimilation. We alone require that our lessons must be learned thoroughly. It should not be up to others to judge us. On the positive side, those of our good actions, such as showing respect for other life forms or those random acts of kindness, will automatically set in motion a positive chain reaction. We magnetically attract to ourselves those bad experiences when we feel a need to learn from them. If we have no need for a hard lesson, we shall not attract it. We magnetize to ourselves those good or bad experiences only when we have a need to learn from them. We must also understand that what we /give/ in the form of energy, creativity or effort, power, to the rest of formation, will eventually be returned to us /tenfold/. Likewise, that which we /take/ from formation in the form of the energy or creativity of others, is a debit, which must ultimately be balanced by our further giving of our own energy in equal amounts in return. All of the newly created ascending souls naturally develop a growing awareness of themselves as an individualized entity. As they ascend from primitive dense worlds, the difficulties of survival can lead the newly created soul to develop a strong independent ego, self, leading to a following ego-centeredness through having been forced to focus on its own personal survival. This strong self-interest usually develops at the expense of others, leading to personal aggression, conflict and to eventual wars, turmoil and strife. However, after a long period of bitter conflict between other competing selves and developing an exhausted state of locked-up confrontation between both sides, where no further gain is to be had, the soul may begin to see the advantages of undertaking a major change of direction towards a more peaceful and cooperative attitude. This will have the effect of starting the soul on its upward path of ascension to eventual unity with the rest of formation. It is only by experiencing the /effects/ of our actions and then correcting them, that the evolving ascending soul learns to be fully able to discriminate between good and evil. The concentration down on third-dimensional planet Earth by all the ego's intent on self-motivation and self-interest explains why political and social relationships have hitherto dominated so much of Earth's human thought and group activity. The older and more evolved worlds on the higher planes maintain a single and simple rule of correct social and political behavior, namely, that we avoid doing anything which can be harmful to others, that we do to others as only we would have them do to us/, a universal law fully accepted on those higher worlds. On the upwards evolutionary ascent we eventually begin to learn that we are totally interlinked with all the rest of formation, with every other living creature and even with every other rock, mineral and plant. The Master Tao, know that you are not, and never have been separate from your source. You truly have never been separate from each other. You have never really been separate from all of the brothers and sisters you have on countless planets throughout your galaxies. You have never been separate from any creature of your planet. Not separate from your sun and your moon, not separate from any leaf, or blade of grass, or flower that blossoms in your garden. You have forgotten, that is all, and in your pain and in your judgment of who you are, you have closed down. You have forgotten that who you are is God, Goddess, smelling the rose of the vibrancy and excitement of this dimension of reality. The development of human morality. In the evolutionary process of ascent that human beings go through to reach the perfection of paradise, the development of intelligence or the mind is not the only important element of evolution. The development of the moral nature in a human, that is morality and its subsequent virtues, becomes the most significant attribute of the human personality. Man's mentality may transcend that of his animal cousins, but it is his moral and religious nature that especially distinguishes him from the animal world. Although the behavioral scientists of Earth have recently discovered that animals do have a very basic sense of morals, that is, a primitive sense of right and wrong and of even helping another when in distress, most of the selective responses of an animal are limited to the reaction level of behavior.